moxie, force of character, determination, or nerve. I'm Sierra Benson, and you're listening to The Moxie Mindset. This podcast is designed to help you grow a healthier, growth-oriented mindset. I've reached out to college professors and professionals who have agreed to come into the studio to help us learn more in depth about the communication and leadership skills we need to succeed. Thank you for joining us on The Moxie Mindset. I'm super stoked for today's episode. Michael Hastings is also Lord Dr. Hastings CBE, a member of the British Parliament in the Upper House of Lords, and Stephen R. Covey Professor of Leadership for the Huntsman Business School at Utah State University, as well as being the Chancellor of Regent's University, London. He is also formerly a senior executive at KPMG International, and before that with the BBC. Michael is also Vice President of UNICEF in the UK and President of Zane, a Zimbabwe aid charity, as well as serving as a governor of the Vodafone-supported MPESA Academy School in Nairobi Academy for 850 of Kenya's poorest children. Thank you, Michael, for coming on today. I have been so enthralled with the class that we've had this past semester. I've learned so much. There's just so many concepts that don't come up in everyday life. And I've wondered, how have you gotten into that environment of learning these types of things? Where have you come from to make you interested in those? And why are you at Utah State of all places?
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, that's quite a compound set of questions there. But let me try and hone in on why am I and was I so keen on this set of themes when we're talking about leadership in a complex world, and why do we need to be very principled about it? And I suppose part of it comes from the fact that I've lived across many continents, and I've seen so much since the tail end of the Second World War to now, which has given me a deep sense of what has been the eroding presence of principles and values in modern public life. Now, you know, every generation says, oh, it always used to be better back then. And that's not quite the case, because in some cases, history was a lot worse than it is now. We have to be thankful to be in a world where the numbers of people who, for example, are extremely poor is relatively small compared to what it was, even in the course of the last 30 to 50 years. So the world has progressed an awful lot. But the one thing that I would say has slid right the way down the agenda of priorities is, what are the values that should determine, the principles that should determine how leadership operates, how decisions are made, how are people supported in their day-to-day lives, and what matters in terms of the integrity of countries and companies and then communities and individuals. We've lost that sense in which those of us living in the rich Western world, the English-speaking world or European languages world, are immensely privileged. And part of that privilege is because we've had a heritage of effective democracy. We've had a heritage of great culture. But both of those things have gone on the slide in the course of 25 to 30 years. So it bothers me deeply. And I want a generation like yours, Sierra, to wake up in the morning and realize, you know, there can be a better way. There are important things that we need to hold dear to our chest, values that we need to prioritize, principles that must determine our priorities, issues that really, truly matter, themes that we should give intentional commitment to. And probably just deepening on a little bit from that for half a second is, you know, in my day when I was at university, we spent all our time in libraries, digging around in books, because we didn't have anything else. And now your generation has got every conceivable kind of electronic gizmo that gives you access through the internet, which is a wonderful, wonderful tool of knowledge and service and information and perspective and history. And yet, it isn't used for that. It is used for the trivial. It's used for sharing silly photographs. It's used for making jokes. It's used for TikToking and passing across dumb stuff. And so a generation is growing up, not actually grabbing the in-your-hand encyclopedia, but instead just saying, hey, look at this silly thing. And I think that is leading us to a much more shallow and inadequate place. And as the world gets more complicated, what's going to be the quality of leaders able to tackle that complexity? So that's why I got so keen on this. And why Utah State? Well, because I was honored to receive in 2019 the Stephen R. Covey Center first ever Principled Leaders Award. And it was very kind of them to identify me for that. And so I came to the campus, and I was very encouraged and impressed by all the students that I met and all the faculty I met. And then the dean came to see me in London and asked if I would consider working on this program with Professor Craig at Utah State University. And I was just thrilled to do it because it meant all the things that I have believed in and that I value so deeply could be put into a curriculum. And I just love the way we're doing it.
Oh, beautiful. There are so many things that I can touch on. I'll come to the first thing that's on my mind. I'm on the cusp of the generation. I'm like the in-between generation where I remember a life without internet. And I remember like the big fat computers where you play pinball and it has like the blue window screen. And it's like right there where internet wasn't always accessible and you didn't spend all of your time on a screen. I remember vividly, I had a journal entry when I was about 10 years or 11 years old, where I said, today was one of the first days where I've sat like for more than 2 or 3 hours on a computer screen. And that was kind of crazy. That was, and it was just talking about like what I experienced by starting to do that. And now it's become every single day, we're always on a screen for that long, for like longer than 3 hours for sure, especially with everything Zoom wise. But now there's a generation that's always had the internet, and I've noticed almost a disconnect where it's the people just a year younger than me that don't remember not having a phone in their hands. I was in about like middle school when we started getting like the flip phones, and you could pay per text. So it got really expensive if you like had a conversation with a friend. But right after that, things started to change and smartphones came on. And now it's just almost a necessity if you're living in America to have a smartphone. And so I've noticed that the people just a couple years younger than me are not holding conversations that are of quality of connection, but more of talking about what's going on the internet and just telling stories that have been on the internet, and none of the engaged, like, tell me about yourself. And that's very generalized. There are lots of people that are younger that can still like connect. But what are your thoughts on that? I've seen it in my own life where I haven't been able to engage as much.
I think, this was an interesting example. Just a few days ago, someone who's 26, I was having a discussion with them about a journey they were going to take from London, which is in the south of England, right up to somewhere in the northeast of England, which is about a 3-hour drive that they were going to go on. And they said, I'll just use Waze. Because I said, but don't you want to know which of the highways you should take, which road you... No, I'll just use Waze. I'll just follow Waze. So I said to this guy, I said, but what you'll end up with is not knowing actually what actual roads you're on. Because all you're doing is following a screen again, And it's telling you, stay on this one, then go left, then go right, stay on this one. And that means that if, and this happened last week, both Facebook and Instagram here went down for a whole 24 hours. Now, people were horrified because all of a sudden their lifeline to expression and their lifeline to receiving was gone. And it caused a real flurry of concern about, how do I know what people are thinking? How do I know what's going on? Because I can't get onto Facebook and I can't get onto Instagram. And so, and I said to this guy, I said, well, you know, you saw that yesterday, the Facebook and Instagram were down for 24 hours. What if you're following this thing Waze, which is very good, and then the internet goes down, the phone signal network goes down, what do you do then? You don't actually know where the place is. And I said, you know, in the old days, we had maps. And we looked at the map and we figured out, oh, so it's north or it's east or, it's, oh, right, west, okay. We figured it out and we got a kind of like a compass in our head and it gave us direction so that we couldn't be victim to an electronic thing that could, at the flash of a button. You know, one of the things that's very interesting about, and I'm not suggesting this is going to happen in America or even happen here, let's hope not, but we saw the possible sign of this on January the 6th, the storming of the Capitol, was you don't know when bizarre, overwhelming, politically controlling groups may take power. We're just seeing, as you and I are talking now, Sierra, we're seeing what was a stable country, Myanmar, for the last decade, all of a sudden now is in complete totalitarian turmoil. And the democratically elected leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who, you know, was a very solid human rights person, but then fell foul of pushing out a large number of people who were desperate Muslims who had the right to live in the country, but she pushed them out. Now the military have taken control again. And all of a sudden, this restored country that we all esteemed has gone. And what's the first thing? What is the first thing that totalitarian regimes do? They cut off the internet. They cut off the communication. So if your generation lives entirely on their phones and the next generation down, well, really, they're in someone else's hands. There's very little power to relate, to connect, to understand, to buy. I mean, I refuse to put credit cards onto my phone because, again, if the phone doesn't work, I've got no access to pay anything. So it's all about thinking about the variables that we need, not opposing technology, which is a wonderful gift, hugely wonderful gift. Everything about the internet's a gift. But I do think that especially the generation younger than you, Sierra, we need to help them, particularly through school and through college, through university, to be able to think without technology, to actually grab the complexity of the issues of the world. Because after all, if you could just press a button and you have a solution, well, then it's not something we've thought about. It's something we've just allowed other people to think about, and then we swallowed it. We do need to develop independent thinking. You know, in the old schools here in England, well, in fact, some still do it now, they always taught, in the very elite schools, they always taught Latin, which is, you think, why are you teaching Latin? I mean, this is really up until the 2000s. Why is a school teaching Latin? Nobody speaks it. Nobody's spoken it for 2,000 years. Why is anybody teaching it? And the reason they teach it is because it develops a very logical, critical, analytical, and ironically mathematical way of thinking. Now, you can't get that by looking at a screen. It has to trigger the parts of the brain that will give us all of that reaction. So this is a fascinating time, you know, and you know, Sierra, as well as anybody, I suppose, you know, we're watching misinformation on the internet about vaccines, for example, about science in general ways, even about political theory. We're watching so much misinformation. And it's easy for people to get swayed and seduced, as they do. So this is a dangerous time. I was reminded, and I'll wrap with this particular comment before we go on to another point, but I was reminded just last week that in 1969, when NASA sent the Apollo mission to the moon and a man landed and walked on the moon, they had a minuscule computer that they thought was huge, that it consumed a whole block of a building. But on your iPhone now, and on my iPhone now, if we have the iPhone 11 onwards, not promoting, but there they are, on our iPhones now, we have 8 million times more processing power and data management than Apollo had in 1969. And just look what we don't do with it. I think the challenge to your generation and the generation below is how to get them excited about being curious. Well, just to grab, you know, to be able to grab knowledge for the sake of it. I remember somebody once saying to me, what is the point of reading William Shakespeare's works or Geoffrey Chaucer's work? I mean, these old literary works. What's the point of reading them? Because they don't relate to today. And the answer is the principles under which people lived well or badly do relate to today. Because the irony is that the principles that deliver effectiveness rarely change. Who live the outcome have changed. So we learn so much by being able to look at things well crafted.
And that's been one thing that I've been wondering about. As I'm growing up, I'm learning that I'm going to have to help like the generation under me and mentor them and coach them. And how do I help them find these tools of curiosity? I know that you can find it within yourself and find that self-motivation. It's funny that you mentioned Latin because it's on my bucket list to learn it. It's just kind of crazy right now with all of college, but I'm hoping as soon as the summer hits, I'm collecting like all of these books and I'm really excited to create my own curriculum for the first time in my life. I'm able to do that. And how do I help others find that curiosity as well as a leader?
You know, I think I'll tell you how I try to do it with younger folk around me is I do two things. One is I try to get them excited by the natural environment. There are literally hundreds of thousands of species of insects and plants, let alone mammals and birds and reptiles. I mean, variety of creative quality that is there in the natural world. And then you go into trees and plants and flowers. Oh, my word, it's overwhelming. It makes for such a discovery, incredible and perpetual discovery. There's so much to find out. And so I always say to, particularly to those who are fathers and mothers with young children, is show your children natural environmental programs, natural wildlife programs. Switch them on to thinking, to see things they've not seen before. There's not too very far away from where I live, there's a museum that is full of stuffed animals and fish and birds and insects and reptiles from every corner of the world, which, of course, because the United Kingdom has been here as Great Britain and Northern Ireland for thousands of years, there were days when explorers went out and found things and brought them back. And we've got a monumental amount of them. And so I take children there to look at literally standing next to a polar bear. It was a real one, but of course it's stuffed up. Standing next to a tiger, so they can see the size of these things. And I think it's incumbent on all of us who get the opportunity to engage someone else's mind, to take them visibly and visually, to experience both in through the screen, but also in practice, what is the vastness of this world in which we live? Not the country that we're in, not just the reality of what we see pumped at us on our television screens, but look way beyond that. So I think that's one way to do it, is to open our minds to the immensity of the world that we live in. And of course, besides that immensity of the world we live in, the immensity of the cosmos that we see at night, look up and stare and think, what on earth is out there? And how far does it go? And all this talk of millions of light years is kind of meaningless to us because we don't know what one light year really feels like, let alone millions of light years, but it gives us a sense of scale. And then the second thing I encourage people to do is to go to somewhere that is deeply uncomfortably different to what you're used to. So instead of taking a wonderful visit, say, from Salt Lake City to New York City, which would be pretty similar in some ways, although the heights of the buildings would be vastly different, but it's still a city to city. It's an American city to an American city. There are great parallels. Go deep into Alaska, or out into the Rocky Mountains. Go into a strange place that's nothing like the normal. Take a look at what grows there. What sounds are there at night? What moves there? What are the roads like in small and different communities which are not part of cities? And get to see, because America has many, many cultures of people. Get to see maybe some of the indigenous cultures of people. How do they live? Switch our minds on. I have a wonderful memory, Sierra, wonderful memory of, this must have been maybe six or seven years ago, when I was with KPMG and I went to Australia, one of my many, many visits to Australia, and went north from Sydney up to Darwin, which is right on the north central coast, in order to visit with a large community of indigenous first Australians. And you know, they're amazingly different people. They're not like a standard Australian. They're very different. I mean, they're dark skinned and their history goes back thousands of years. And I turned up at this place in a light suit. Just wanted to be respectful to them, but they insisted that I sit on the floor in the dust, cross legs, because they were all sitting on the ground in the dust, cross legs, because they like to be close to the earth, and so they wanted to express their closeness to the earth. And they wanted me to appreciate that. And then we had this incredible conversation. It went on for hours and hours and hours, at least 3 hours, with them sitting cross-legged in the dust, men and women, and me sitting cross-legged in the dust, and my suit getting completely dusty, and just talking about the history of change. You know, because they can remember in their archives, it goes back thousands of years for them, not hundreds, thousands of years. And of course, they think thousands of years forward. Wow. What a joy to have that experience. So that would be my two things. I'd say, go discover the world you can't see, and particularly the natural world that most of us don't come across because we live in cities too much.
Yeah. When I was younger, my aunt, she majored in, I want to say, horticulture or something of the nature around us. And she would take me out when I was about like 5 years old, and she would pick leaves off of plants and she would have me hold it in my hand and she'd tell me the name of it. And then she'd tell me the scientific name of it. And then she would tell me about the soil that it grows in and all of the different soils that are on the earth. And then she would talk about the rocks. And then we would go back to my house and she would point out the different weeds that grow and all of the different names that those have. And still, when I go home, I look at that and I'm I always remember that it's a kochia weed that is that very specific plant that grows everywhere in Utah and everywhere in Idaho. But having those experiences helped me realize and notice the things that are around me. And how did that experience, especially with the Indigenous people of Australia, how did it change the way that you viewed the world, maybe in one tiny specific instance?
Oh, I think one of the things I learned in that experience, which is actually paralleled to by being in Japan and then also in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, which is that traditional cultures, more traditional cultures, not fast Western McDonald's cultures, more traditional cultures, they have a long discourse they need to go through. Nobody's rushing at making decisions. You know, one of the habits of American society and British society and European society is we all want to get everything done so quickly. We're always in a hurry. Always in a hurry. Rush. Whereas these wonderful Aboriginal, Indigenous Australians, they were first Australians, as they like to be called now, quite rightly so, because they were there first. They like to sit and talk. Like the Japanese do exactly the same thing. You know, they're in, and the Japanese are an example of a sophisticated, modern, electronic culture. But they are, their culture says, you talk and talk and talk. And a lot of African cultures are like that. You don't try to reach a decision. There's no agenda that says decision by 4 o'clock. It doesn't work like that. And, you know, somebody said something very interesting to me about when there was, you'll remember, Sierra, in 2008 to 2010, we had what we call the global financial crisis, when markets melted down and house values went down and there was a lot of unemployment and economic pressure in every corner of the world, but you know, especially in the richer nations, a lot of economic pressure. And somebody commented here that if only we'd had the mindset of first Australians and sub-Saharan Africans and the Japanese, if only we had the mindset that said we need to consider more carefully the decision that is in front of us, so that actually rather than us rushing at the decision and that meaning, for example, that we can't sustain parts of the economy and then we go into a spiral of collapse and fear, which is partly what happened, that by having this long discourse, long conversation, you get to understand differently. You know, the tendency to wrap everything up quickly, to say everything's been said that can be said, I now understand it, now we'll just make a decision. Well, that means you don't really get it. So I think that's a big learning, you know, how come Japan can do it and be thriving? I know it has a big corporate debt, but it is within its repayment options. It's a very sophisticated modern society, but it runs off that spiritual principle. I better understand you before than I can make a decision with you.
Oh, I'm loving that. It's just interesting to wrap your head around, especially after being in a culture of rushing for your entire life. And one thing that made me think about was when you're always rushing to make a decision, you don't always think critically or deep or long about particular topics. How do you cultivate that through connecting in nature and those things we've been talking about? Do you connect it with engaging others in conversations around that topic? How do you keep in mind slowing down to make these decisions when you're just surrounded by a world that wants you to make a make a decision by 4 p.m. on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose it'll all be down to the cultures of organizations as to whether they're willing to stretch this elastic a little bit more. And we need to do that sometimes. You know, we make rapid and sometimes very bad economic and social structure decisions because either somebody must be to blame, or the money must be spent, or the governor or the mayor says this must happen, or the president says this must happen. So rapid decision making is in front of everybody, but not everybody can live with that decision making. So the need to be calm and understand what doesn't work any longer, and then either change it or change locations. When you think about that kind of one, I just think we need to be willing to pause more. But you know, that's like any habit. When you're studying, and I'm sure you've had a bit of this, Sherry, repetition does help. So whether it's a class, or it's something that you're trying to manage on your course, if you can repeat it back to yourself, it's more likely to find a resonance in your system. And we really do need to grab these principles that say, you know, there's a different way to coming to decisions than the way we've always done it. We don't have to rush. Let us give the time for this thing to breathe so we can make better decisions, more long-lasting decisions, less threatening decisions. And I think one of the things that means is, you know, we have to do less. We rush so many things because we're desperate to get the decision out of the way.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the virtue of patience.
Oh. Yes. Yes, the virtue of patience. Yeah. And, you know, it's a spiritual principle, which is profoundly important, but it's also better decisions are made when calmer heads come together. And in that global financial crisis, everybody afterwards acknowledged that if calmer, more reflective heads had been in the room, fewer bad decisions would get made. It's the urgent decisions which are the ones that trip us up.
How does this pertain when we're in this digital age of misinformation?
Well, I think that misinformation thing is right at the core of what we've been discussing, because we've spent this period of time now talking to each other, and this has been great. But we could have spent the time diving into our phones onto a theme, an issue, a story, a personality, piece of history, a piece of thinking, and get in there and dive in and learn a lot. You know, I have a friend who studied at an American university. It was Harvard. And then went to work in the Stanford area, in the Los Angeles area. Then came to work in the United Kingdom. Now he's in South Africa. And he, when he was at Harvard, was so keen to understand more than he was being taught, and that he could read. He thought, "How am I going to get more information?" And his answer was to listen on a daily basis to the BBC's World Service. This is a news information service that comes from London to every corner of the world in English and in a lot of languages. I think it's like something like 30 languages. And he started listening to the BBC World Service in Harvard. And he discovered that there was a massive problem of orphan abandonment in sub-Saharan Africa. And he didn't know that because he thought that little children were always contained within bigger families. That's the image you're given. But the BBC had done this series of programs which looked at orphan issues worldwide. and the insecurities of, that orphan life breeds in the young person. But that came about because he's trying to understand the world differently. And so once he's understood that, what did he do? Well, he set up a foundation, which he and his wife now put in, set up a foundation in order to provide the money, in order to see orphan children go to some of the best schools that particularly South Africa has to offer and pay for them to go into university. And this will change the whole of that society in time. It's what we can do when we open our eyes.
Yeah. You definitely don't know what you don't know.
Yes.
Until you search it out. I really love that concept of listening to that, not only in English, but being able to expand your vocabulary in the language that you're learning. But more than that, learning about the world around you. So thank you for mentioning that, the tool of the BBC World Service. I ask my guests two questions at the end of every podcast. And the first is, what would you tell your younger self?
I would say, I mean, you hit the word, I would say, be patient. So much you think you really can achieve and you want to achieve. So much of life's journey you want to weave. Be patient. You know, there's a lot of, when I'm helping young married couples get ready for getting married, and I say to them, you know, before you get married, yes, work away at removing all the obstacles to the other person's joy in you. But deal with them. But if you can't get them all done, you've got the next 70 years to work it out. Take your time. Take your time. There's a huge rush in your generation. But we know when it comes to these critical areas of principles and priorities, effective habits, as Stephen R. Covey would call them, quite rightly so, when it comes to all of these, you can read about them in a minute, but it can take decades to put them into practice. So I agree with you that it would make a very big difference in all of our lives if there were more literate, cultured, politically astute, mathematically clever, and economically sound people who could hold the bridge of all of these big themes and lift our minds, lift our eyes.
Thank you. And the last question is just, if we have questions, if we want to know more about the work that you're doing and all of the different foundations and projects and organizations you're a part of, where can we find some of them?
Well, I would say start with the United Nations, start with the UN, because the Sustainable Development Goals that we've been talking about a bit in class, you know, there is 17 critical goals that cover everything from literally protecting the fish in the sea through to dignity for women and advancement for women, to court systems and justice and policing, and right back to the necessity for consistent high-quality education. It's all there. And what you'll find on the UN system is that they will, besides these sustainable development goals, these key themes of world impact that's going to give us a genuinely better world if we do them, besides that, they have lists of associated NGOs and not-for-profit organizations which are connected through the UN system. So like UNICEF is a good example, United Nations International Children's Fund. Everyone knows it as UNICEF, but it's a UN, United Nations organization. I think go there to start off with and follow the links.
Awesome. Thanks so much. I really do appreciate that the time that we've had today, Michael. And I've learned so much from you and the class that we've had, and just opening my eyes to the things that really are in the world that are international and global and that you can actually do something about. So thank you.
Thank you too. And I hope to physically see you there at some point.
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. I'm so excited for that day when we can all see each other in person.
Yes, yes. Oh, thank you so much, Sierra. Bless you.
Hey, it's Sierra, and I hope you enjoyed that episode. I hope it led you to a more positive mindset, a more defined view of leadership, and some action items to take along with you. For more information, you can check out the Moxie website at themoxiemindset.org. Thanks for tuning in today, and I'll see you next week on The Moxie Mindset.